Hello, and welcome to the Space Coast Pet Podcast, the podcast for pets and the people who love them. Now here's your host, veterinarian Dr. Roger Welton.
Hello, pet lovers, and welcome to the Space Coast Pet Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Roger Welton, a.k.a. Dr. Roger, coming to you from the Florida Space Coast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today we are broaching one of my favorite topics, which is breeders. No, I actually can't stand breeders. I loathe breeders. There's actually two breeders in this entire planet that I actually work with because they are excellent breeders and they do things right. They are probably the 0.1% top echelon. If you look at the greater percentage of breeders that are out there that do very few things correctly, that are actually ethical and actually offer good advice founded in science, utilizing the services of a licensed veterinarian. But we're going to jump into that in just a moment. We have a great listener email today in response to my pet food and nutrition podcast. It's a very, 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 very good email, and it's from Susan from Rensselaer County, New York. Thank you so much for taking the time to comment, and lots to unwrap here in this email, and it's a common discussion I have, but this is a good discussion. This is not a dogma-related discussion, so let's jump into it. Hi, Dr. Roger. Just listened to your recent podcast on pet food and nutrition. I agree feeding our pets has become somewhat of a dogma. It's become very personal. I'm one of those that heed my vet's advice until Royal Canin, Purina Hills come up. Here's my problem. When I look at the ingredients and things like pork byproduct meal are the primary source of protein, my immediate reaction is, quote, hell no. One of my corgis was diagnosed with chronic kidney disease at 12, and I was advised to feed Hill's Science Diet KD. Pork byproduct meal was the first ingredient. I chose a referral to University of Tennessee Vet Nutrition Service and home cooked for 4 years. My breeder and my vet wanted my puppy to have Royal Canin and medium breed puppy formula, protein source, chicken byproduct meal. I reluctantly fed it. I got the concept of, quote, whatever meal isn't necessarily a bad thing since deboned chicken, etc. is mostly water. And I trust Hill's Royal Canin Purina to get the chemistry right. It's how they source those nutrients that make me cringe. Susan Rensselaer County, New York. So sorry, I'm not going to include your last name. It was there. But this is the kind of discussion we should be having. Because we see byproduct, and certainly byproduct can be bad. When you're looking at some of the Walmart brand foods that are out there, your old Roy, Bill Jack, back in the day there was Alpo, Mighty Dog. Those guys are probably using bad byproduct, but there can be good byproducts. Let's give you an example of byproduct. Kidneys are byproduct. Brain is byproduct. Heart muscle is byproduct. These are all things that most of us don't want to eat. There are some people that, will eat these things, but generally we don't want to eat kidneys. We don't want to eat brain. We don't want to eat pancreas, right? I'm certainly not going to go to the restaurant and order pancreas with a side of brain. But these are very nutrient dense organs. Some people eat liver, but that's more of like an older generation thing. A lot of people aren't eating liver, so even liver is becoming an important byproduct. So when you look at Royal Canin and when you look at Hill's and you actually visit their facilities and the ingredients that they use, they're not using byproduct that is derived from, say, like hair and hoof and things of that nature. This byproduct, or even skin, this byproduct is these things that generally people are not going to eat, that can be used, that are very nutrient rich in these diets. And so when we see byproduct, it really comes down to the reputation of the company that's utilizing them, because These things are very healthy. You look at brain, for example. I mean, the concept of us eating brain is hideous, but there are actually many cultures that do eat brain, human cultures, that is. But in our country, we're generally not going to do that. Most of Western civilization is not going to eat brain. So I would counter your discussion here by saying that the byproduct used by Rocanin Hills, and I'm not going to put Purina necessarily in that bucket, with the exception of the Pro Plan line, which I think is in line with a Royal Canin Hills quality product. They're using good byproducts. They're not throwing hoof in there, right? But on a positive note, though, you saw that there was this recommendation for KD, and rather than dismiss it over the byproduct, you actually went to University of Tennessee, and you actually seeked out the veterinary nutrition service. So you probably worked with a veterinary clinical nutritionist, and you home cooked. And so they came up with a home cooked recipe that you were comfortable with, that, God, if you did it for 4 years, that is a healthy prognosis for chronic kidney disease at 12. 4 more years, you did something right, and you did it under the guidance of a veterinary clinical nutritionist. So I applaud that, and I really appreciate this email, because this is a good discussion to have. So thank you for listening, and thank you for taking the time to put together an email that really was enjoyable to have the discussion. I'm certainly open to more discussion if you want to have a back and forth. I would love to expand on that further if you have any more to say about it. So thanks again. Let's talk about my favorite topic, breeders. You guys know I feel about breeders are just some of the worst humans I've ever met are breeders. If you're a breeder and it offends you, I don't care. So that's how I feel about breeders. Essentially, one of the biggest frustrations when I come into an examination room and I'm seeing a puppy or a kitten, is when I am being told that, no, my breeder said I shouldn't do that. And actually, it spurred this episode, because just recently I had of all things, a French bulldog that came in, and it was the lady's son who had bought the dog for her and her husband. And so the son didn't come in, but he sent her with information of breeder recommendations that your vet's probably going to bring up, but you shouldn't do. It was, of course, a leptospirosis vaccine. So, number one breeder mythology that I don't know why they continue to put this out there, because there's no scientific basis for it, is leptospirosis vaccine is dangerous and unnecessary. And this really gets my goat, because I see a small percentage. Granted, it is a small percentage, but completely unnecessarily die from this disease. It has a 30% mortality rate. It is spread through the urine of rodents, including squirrels. Most suburban and even urban areas have squirrels. If you don't think you got rats around you, you're wrong. Rats are everywhere, mice are everywhere. They may not be visible in your home, but trust me, they are everywhere. Especially if you live near water, they tend to thrive near water sources because they need water to drink. And so, where there's water, there's rats and mice. And of course, in suburban environments and where there's restaurants and human refuse waste, that is a prime feeding area for them. And so, wherever there's human activity, there is rodents, and there's therefore leptospirosis. And so that explains why we see more lepto in urban and suburban environments. We also see more lepto in our small little foo-foo dogs versus our bigger dogs. So another breeder misconception is they say leptospirosis is so unnecessary for a companion dog, because really, you're really only worried about that for dogs that go out in the woods, hunting dogs, rural environments. No, Mr. or Mrs. Breeder. The polar opposite is true. It's your Yorkies, it's your Frenchies, it's your Maltese. The majority of leptospirosis I've seen are like these little companion spoiled little foo-foo dogs that barely touch the ground. I actually don't see it a ton in bigger dogs. I don't think I've seen it in one single hunting dog. It is companion dogs that are low to the ground, that lick their feet, that are, you know, if there's any moisture in the soil or in the environment, leptospirosis can live up to 7 days in fresh standing water and or in moist soil. So it gets on their feet, they lick their feet because a squirrel just peed there or peed there as long as 7 days ago. Yeah, your dog can get leptospirosis from that. Very dangerous disease. It also, folks, is a zoonotic disease. Zoonotic diseases are diseases that people can catch from animals. Not the most common thing either, but you don't want leptospirosis. You don't want it being propagated through your dog, and you certainly don't want it in contact with you. So do the leptospirosis vaccine. To hell with your breeder. They don't know what they're talking about. So let me just go back to this visit. So I asked the lady, so the lady said to me, my son said the breeder said not to give that vaccine. I'm like, okay, on what basis? She goes, I don't know. She said it's bad. I'm like, why is it bad? She said, I don't know, like it causes seizures or something. I'm like, never seen it once. She goes, okay, well, I still want to talk to my son first. Let him call the breeder and we'll think about it. I said, okay, let me just explain to you, you know, what leptospirosis is. The other thing I explained to her that I want to explain to all of you folks is that guess what's more reactive than the lepto vaccine? Rabies. Are we going to stop giving that? I don't think so. Rabies has a higher reactivity rate than leptospirosis does. By the way, the reactivity rates of all our vaccines are exceedingly low. And when I say reactivity, I don't mean the immune response and they're a little sleepy the next day. They might have a little soreness at the injection spot. No, that's not what I mean. I mean like a reaction where they got to come back and I'm giving them cortisone and antihistamines because, you know, their face swells and they're itchy. And those kind of reactions are so exceedingly rare. I see a reaction like that once every 2 to 3 years, in all honesty. So, in the vast majority of cases, when we see those rare reactions, not just to lepto, but to any vaccine, it's very fixable, and then you take precautions in the future and just give them some antihistamines prior to vaccination. But it is grossly irresponsible for breeders to be doing that. I had a very holistic, not had, have still, current tense, a very holistically minded naturalist type of client who I really like and appreciate. And she's always asking me questions and bringing things up in our friend Susan, who sent me the email in that fashion, in an intelligent manner, not with dogma, but with, you know, realistic and you know, justifiable concern, right? She actually was one of those that continued to not do the leptospirosis vaccine in her little Scottish Terrier. And I respect people's decision. Ultimately, if they don't do the lepto, they listen to the stupid breeder. Okay, fine. That's on you if something happens to your dog. I did the best I could. You're going to listen to the breeder, and that's just what you're going to do. I stopped getting offended by that a long time ago because it just happens all too commonly. And, you know, all I can do is my own diligence. And if you don't want to follow it, well, you know, that's your problem. It's not mine. So at any rate, thankfully, nothing ever badly happened to this dog, but her friend's corgi, Ms. Susan, and also my favorite groomer with the corgi out in California. My apologies, your name escapes me right now. Paula, hello, out in California with your corgi. Her one of her really good friends had a corgi die of leptospirosis, and what was really troubling to her, it was right on her street. So she discovered the hard way that, hey, there's leptospirosis out there. A dog can die from it. The dog was 4 years old and died of leptospirosis. Guess what she did? She came in immediately and started the lepto series. We boosted it, and her dog's been getting it ever since. And guess what? No reaction. So very quickly, where did this foul taste come from about the leptospirosis vaccine? Just in case you guys jump on Google after this, there was way past tense a time when leptospirosis actually, in fact, did have a higher reactivity rate than other vaccines. This dates back to, ready for this, 2003. Okay, so there was this unscrupulous, unethical pharmaceutical company that thankfully no longer exists called Fort Dodge. And they were the morons that came up with an FIV vaccine. FIV is feline immunodeficiency virus. It's like HIV in people, but in cats. The vaccine didn't work. It didn't hurt anybody, but it gave this sort of false pretense that the cats were protected from FIV. How they got this thing out to market is I don't know. They had a Giardia vaccine. Giardia is a protozoal parasite that is extremely treatable. It's a protozoan also, so like how you're stimulating the immune response to target a protozoan doesn't make sense to me. So that, this is the kind of crap that this company pulled. And so leptospirosis was a growing concern because as we continued our urban sprawl into more natural environments, we saw lepto on the rise. It's still on the rise because we continue our urban sprawl. So wherever you have people coming in contact with nature, you're going to increase the potential for certain diseases. Leptospirosis is one of them. That's why it's on the rise here in Florida. I saw actually more lepto back in the day when I worked in New York and Long Island because the urban sprawl had already happened. Then initially when I moved here in Florida in 2004, didn't see much lepto at all. But I've seen it, like the cases go on the uptick because like in New York where I was living and practicing, the urban sprawl had already happened. The lepto is there. Here we're encroaching into it and increasing our susceptibility to it. And so I'm seeing it on the rise here for that reason. So at any rate, I bring that up because my client was scared straight into getting the vaccine, and she did point to Fort Dodge. And I said to her, well, Fort Dodge has not existed for a very long time. Finally, I believe it was the lepto vaccine that finally was the nail in their coffin. So they put out this vaccine, they rushed it out to market. We're administering it as veterinarians, and we did see this higher reactivity rate. And so for 4 years, I actually did not vaccinate for leptospirosis. What happened was two things occurred. So number one, I moved to Florida in 04. The veterinarian I purchased the practice from, she goes, I don't vaccinate for lepto. Honestly, I didn't like the reactivity that happened from the Fort Dodge vaccine. And I honestly, we really don't see it. So I went by that. I didn't vaccinate for lepto. Even though in 06, the vaccine was developed properly by Pfizer. Pfizer is now, they sold off their animal health division and they're a company called Zoetis, still a great pharmaceutical company. But at the time, it was developed by Pfizer. It was very safe. It had a very high efficacy. Now, just about everybody makes, oh, not everybody, but let me say the good pharmaceuticals that are out there, Elanco, Zoetis, Merck, all very good companies. They all have their own version of the lepto vaccine, all very safe, all very effective. The statistic is if you vaccinate your dog for leptospirosis, you have a 96% efficacy. That's crazy efficacy. That's almost taking it out of the equation that your dog has any probability of ever contracted leptospirosis when coming in contact with it. So great efficacy, great safety. This happened as of 06. Well, I still didn't vaccinate up until 08. Number one, I still had the foul taste in my mouth from Fort Dodge, but also, even with the safety data really being compelling, I'm like, I don't need to vaccinate for this. Well, lo and behold, I got three cases in 08, right? And I'm like, oh, okay. And one of them died. So I'm like, well, it's time to start vaccinating. And ever since I have. So since 2008, I've vaccinated. I've been very happy. I use the Merck vaccine personally. Merck is an excellent company. But don't listen to your breeder on this. Leptospirosis is a real disease. It is not frivolous to vaccinate for it. And I'm going to repeat, it is not dangerous. And by the way, dumbass breeder who told, not that she's actually listening because nobody, breeders don't listen to anybody that actually has an education. That person, it does not cause seizures. It does not cause seizures. By the way, that client, she has followed every other recommendation. She's still ruminating on the vaccine and doing quote unquote research, which means she's probably Googling it. So, That's one of the big mythologies that the one of the biggest ones that I wanted to conquer, because like my client's friend who lost her corgi, it was so unnecessary, and she made that decision based on breeder advice. The other thing, while we're on the topic of vaccines, is unfortunately in this country, people that are not veterinarians are allowed to purchase vaccines and administer them themselves, either to their own pets or to the offspring of their pets that they are wanting to sell, aka breeders. The only vaccine that they are not allowed to purchase and administer is rabies. Rabies is one that, because it is such a horrible and dangerous human health hazard and is very zoonotic, that is a vaccine that I don't know, I'm stumbling here because I don't know if it's at the federal level. I'm pretty sure it's at the state level, but I've worked in three states so far, New York, New Jersey, and Florida. And in all three states that I've worked in, it is illegal for anybody to purchase the rabies vaccine and administer it outside of a licensed veterinarian. So I do have colleagues in my veterinary management group that are from all over the country, certainly not from all 50 states, but California, Washington State, South Carolina, North Carolina. Every state that I'm aware of has this law. But outside of that, everything else, free game. You can purchase it. I don't know where to go to purchase it or where they go to purchase it, but they can purchase vaccines. So here's why that's bad. First off, very, very big red flag if there is a breeder that is giving her own or his own vaccines to the puppies. Number one, they almost never follow the AVMA AHA protocols. So AVMA is the American Veterinary Medical Association. They are a governing body. AHA is the American Animal Hospital Association. They are the governing body for accreditation for best practices, and they are both top-notch organizations that better our profession. And those two organizations teamed up actually in the early 2000s to create vaccine reform, meaning that we are administering vaccines based on a geographic need basis. So a great example is in New York. I vaccinated for Lyme disease because I saw 5 to 7 cases a month. Here in Florida, I don't vaccinate for Lyme disease because there is no Lyme disease, at least at this point in time. So we were encouraged via those governing bodies, do not vaccinate for things that are diseases that are not endemic to the area where the pet lives, and that makes perfect sense to me. I am not shy about vaccines. I'm not afraid of vaccines, but certainly I don't want to give unnecessary vaccines, and I think we can all be on that page. I don't think every single veterinarian subscribes to that, aka high volume, low cost vaccine clinics, but that's a whole other subject. But any ethical veterinarian is not going to want to unnecessarily vaccinate. Now, one thing about Lyme real quick is if I have a quote unquote snowbird, so these are the luckiest people on the planet that actually spend their summers up north and their winters down here. Oh, what a life that is. Yes, I'm going to vaccinate those patients for Lyme because they're going up north for the summer. In these areas up north, Lyme disease is just about everywhere once you go north of Jacksonville. So you're already seeing Lyme disease in Georgia. And all the way north in the summer, there's ticks. Ticks spread Lyme disease. So yes, I do vaccinate those patients. But back to the topic, sorry about that tangent. Breeders that self-vaccinate, big red flag, stay the heck away from them. Don't pay $7,000 on a Frenchie for a breeder that is too freaking cheap to have their puppies actually examined and vaccinated properly with good quality vaccines from good reputable pharmaceuticals like Elanco-Zoetis Merck. Don't do that. I mean, how can you be selling, when I say $7,000 for a Frenchie, I am not kidding. I have a client that spent $7,500 for a Frenchie, and the dog came with it. The puppy ended up getting a cherry eye. It was recommended that the puppy not get a spayed until it had 2 heat cycles. That's my next breeder mythology, by the way. We'll get to that in a moment. You know, and doing her own vaccines. It's like, come on, man. and they do the weirdest protocols. They don't know what in the hell they're doing. And so vaccine protocols, I'm just going to tell you from the puppy and kitten side what should be happening here per the AVMA and American Animal Hospital Association. So a puppy and kitten should not have their first vaccine until 8 weeks of age. So a lot of these breeders are doing them at 5 and 6 weeks. Those vaccines are basically worthless. They've stimulated that young immune system for no reason. Maternal antibodies are not really falling off to the extent that we're concerned until about 6 to 8 weeks. And so at 8 weeks, we're starting in puppies the DHPP, distemper, hepatitis, parvo, parot, influenza. In felines, we're starting the FVRCP. The FVRCP is a 4-in-1 vaccine. It covers panleukopenia, rhinotracheitis, calicivirus, virus, and chlamydia. And so those are, that's your kitten vaccine, quote unquote, and your quote unquote puppy vaccine. At 3 weeks after that, so the 11-week mark, we are boosting those two vaccines, the core vaccines, and then we are, for the felines, introducing feline leukemia, virus vaccine, and then for puppies at 11 weeks, we're starting the leptospirosis vaccine. And then 3 weeks after that, that brings us to 14 weeks of age. We are doing, if they're medium to smaller dogs, we're gonna do one last booster of that DHPP puppy vaccine. We're gonna do the second and last booster of leptospirosis. In the case of kittens, we are doing the FVRCP kitten vaccine, and then we're done at that point. And then for the feline leukemia, we're doing the second and last booster of that. 3 weeks after that, the kittens come back for rabies only, and dogs come back for rabies only. If we have a large to giant breed, though, I do one additional fourth DHPP because the bigger the dog, the higher susceptibility to one of the viruses in that vaccine called parvo. Especially Rottweilers are especially prone to parvo, so we like to do that fourth booster. And that's what they should be doing. So, you want to rewind that and write that down. If you're in the market for a dog or a cat, just say, this is what my vet does. Can you please follow this? And by the way, can you have it done by a real veterinarian? Okay, so that's second breeder mythology. Not following AVMA AHA protocols, not having it done by a licensed veterinarian. That means, you know what that means, folks? That means these expensive ass dogs that people are paying a fortune for. A veterinarian's not even laid a stethoscope on these animals, and you're paying thousands of dollars for them. It's insane. It's insane. It's just beyond insane. Another huge thing that I want you to spread far and wide. Again, every state that I am aware of mandates this. It is not legal to sell an animal without a state issued health certificate for sale signed by a licensed veterinarian. It's illegal. You can't sell cattle without it. You can't sell dogs and cats without it. Yet 99% of breeders don't supply a state issued health certificate signed by a veterinarian. Guess who does? The two breeders that I work with, because they do things right. They're magnificent people. They put forth champion level. One is a bulldog breeder, English bulldog. One is a Great Dane breeder. They're putting out champion level, like I'm talking Westminster Dog Show quality dogs that are healthy, have amazing temperaments. They're doing all kinds of certifications on the breeding animals to just do their best diligence that the offspring are going to not propagate these diseases. If one disease does pop up in one of these offspring, it's actually in the contract of the people that buy them that they are to cease and desist breeding. Now, it's dubious and questionable whether or not those contracts are legally binding. They're probably not, but at least they're doing the deterrent there. But the one with the Great Dane breeder in particular, she's not seen any genetic disease pop up in any of the offspring of her breeding animals. Her one sire is ranked 27th in the country on the dog show circuit. So, that's the kind of breeders that I will work with. But at any rate, the next mythology I want to talk about is spay neuter. They're on the female side, it's really annoying. So there is some data on the male side when it comes to large and giant breed dogs, that there is a small, it's a very small but evident uptick in neutering male dogs prior to 14 months of age. Small uptick in cranial cruciate tears of the knee, and the development of hip dysplasia prior to and up to 2 years of age. Hip dysplasia is a malformation of the hip joints, and cranial cruciate ligament tear is a tear of the major stabilizing ligament in the canine knee. The uptick to me, and I can't throw out percentages off the top of my head, I want to say it's like 1.2% on the cruciate. I want to say it's like less than 1% on the hip dysplasia. So for me, like, as a pet owner, I'm like, this is like, I don't know, statistically so irrelevant to me. I want to preserve my dog's temperament and make sure that I don't get any unwanted male behavior that sometimes doesn't go away post-neuter, you know, marking in the home, aggression, wanting to escape and go find a girlfriend, just generally being bad dogs. You know, these things can happen, and then people want to neuter them, and, you know, I neuter them and they stay bad dogs. So for me, I'm still, personally, I am neutering any dog at 6 months of age. The uptick to me doesn't matter, but for people that statistically it matters to them, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to judge that. What I recommend to them is, okay, well, as this dog is heading into sexual maturity, if you start to see unwanted behavior that you don't think you can train out of this dog, you may want to get him neutered before that gets worse. Again, that's up to you. but the breeders are saying don't neuter them for 2 years, okay? And I'm like, come on, man. So the data went, the really relevant study came out of Tufts University. What I didn't like about that study is strictly German Shepherds. You know, there's a lot of other, you know, breeds in German Shepherds. Just because it affects Shepherds, you know, a certain way doesn't mean it's necessarily going to affect, say, a Labrador Retriever. There was a bigger study done at UC Davis, but that study was only Golden Retrievers. But what I did notice in the difference between the two studies is that it was slightly more clinically relevant in the German Shepherd than it was in the Golden Retriever. And so it seems that the bigger the dog, the more clinically relevant it might be. Still, even if I had a Great Dane, I'd be neutering him 6 months of age, just saying. but the breeders are saying 2 years. Some are saying never neuter your dog. Never do it. Never do it. It's bad for him. Tell that to the Shih Tzu I saw about 6 weeks ago, who was never neutered, and came in with a giant swelling coming out the side of his rear end, just next to his tail. This dog had a prostate the size of a plum, and it was occluding his ability to have a bowel movement because the prostate was pushing on his rectal colon. And all the pushing, he blew out a perineal hernia. And so I had to go in surgically and tuck all those guts back in. There was an intestine coming out, even the prostate was herniating out through there. Tuck all that in and close it all up and put this dog through the surgery. That was so unnecessary because had he been neutered, his prostate wouldn't have gotten huge. So, you know, to tell them to never neuter their dog, how about Sertoli cell tumor? That's testicular cancer. That's something that we realistically see. Why make your dog susceptible to that? So bad advice. Bad advice. Hey, look, so on the male side, you want to wait till 14 months? Fine. If the breeder gives you that advice, they're not really wrong. But 2 years and never, that's wrong. Let's talk about another on the female side, spaying. They're recommending at least two heats, most of them, breeders I'm saying. Many are saying at least one heat prior to spaying. Okay, let me tell you how stupid that is. So first off, orthopedically, doesn't matter the breed. There's been no statistical conclusion. That's how close the data is. There's but no statistical conclusion that there has been any negative effect to the female dog in development. So really what it comes down to is statistically, there is no reason to let the dog have a heat. There is absolutely no reason. Here's what you're accomplishing by listening to your breeder and letting them have one or two heat cycles. So I've talked about this before, but if you've heard it already, my apologies, but I get new listeners every day, or not every day, every episode. And I just want to preach this from the highest mountaintop that I can, because yes, we spay for pregnancy prevention. We spay to take away the possibility of pyometra, which as dogs and cats age, their heat cycles could become abnormal and predispose them to these ascending infections into the uterus, which are, that's an emergency surgery. We have a saying, don't ever let the sun set on a pyometra, meaning operate immediately if they have a pyometra, because that's how dangerous it is when you diagnose it. So we prevent pyometra, and of course we take away the inconvenience of dealing with a heat cycle, which can be messy 2 times a year if it's a dog, every other month if it's a cat. So the cats can be really a pain if you don't spay them. So, but the biggest reason for me is cancer prevention. I just removed, actually, just last week, a cancerous mammary tumor. I did a mastectomy on a dachshund that was not spayed. And it came back low-grade adenocarcinoma with a fair prognosis. So this dog got lucky. About 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks prior to that, I removed a high-grade adenocarcinoma in a dog that was spayed, but not spayed till later in life because the dog was a rescue. Sadly, that dog had to be put to sleep last week because it had spread everywhere. I did remove it. We gave that dog a small reprieve, but you know it had already metted by the time we got to it. By metted, I mean metastasized on other parts of the body. So that's how serious mammary cancer is. Well, when we spay the dog before the first heat cycle, we reduce the incidence of mammary cancer by, ready for this, 88%. That's massive. In a cat, before the first heat cycle, you reduce the incidence of mammary cancer by over 90%, right? So we let them have one heat cycle, like your dumb breeder tells you to do. We lose the preventative aspect of cancer as it pertains to the spay. It drops to 55%. In cats, around the same. We let them have a second heat cycle, like the majority of dumb breeders are having their customers do. We drop to 27%, around the same for a cat as well, okay? So you go from 88, if you listen to your vet, listen to your breeder who says one heat, you drop to 55%. If you listen to the most breeders and let them have two heat cycles, you drop to 27%. Temperament-wise, we have a saying in veterinary medicine, they don't call them bitches for nothing. Estrogen is a hormone in the mammalian species that serves many functions, reproduction of course, but it also primes the female to have offspring, and those offspring have to be fed, they have to be protected. In many mammalian species, they have to do so without a daddy around. If it's a cat, for example, there's no daddy around, it's up to that mama. And so what estrogen does for many of these animals is it gives them an edge, makes them ornery, makes them really hyper aware of their environment, in many cases skittish. So when you look at like horses, for example, notoriously mares are challenging to work with. My daughter's got a mare, she's ornery, she spooks easily. The reason she puts up with her is because she could jump out of the arena. My daughter does hunter jumper, and boy can Stratus jump. But you know who's the mushy gushy love of her life? Is her other horse that is now just does lessoning on students, but she started on him. His name's Newton. He's a quarter pony, and he's a gelding. A gelding is a neutered male, and he's a big marshmallow, right? There's a big difference. And so the same applies to dogs and cats. They get that estrogen introduced. You spay them, that orneriness does not always go away. So think about temperament as well. So that's another breeder mythology. And then they have really interesting opinions on nutrition. I just did a whole podcast on nutrition, so I'm probably not going to go there, but I'm just going to say, you know, either listen to your vet or do your diligence, like Susan, who emailed and maybe work in conjunction with a veterinarian. I mean, if you go to her level, veterinary clinical nutritionist at veterinary university, well, they're better than anything I'm going to tell you. But I can at least go on the veterinary information network on behalf of a client if they are, really committed to feeding fresh food. I'll find you recipes, right? Ones that are designed by veterinary clinical nutritionists. I could even find you recipes for disease-specific nutrition. So, feel free to have these conversations with your vet. And I know things are too important, and love of our animals is too important for people to take offense. I can't help but state, in all honesty, I gotta be honest with everybody, that when I hear, "Well, my breeder said," I internally cringe just a little bit, because I'm sitting there like, okay, well, why are you bringing your dog to me? Bring it to your breeder. Like, if they know everything, what are you doing here paying me good money for? Your breeder's the genius, right? Just go there. So that's the cynical part of me. But anyway, at any rate, it's not going away anytime soon. Paula, the groomer, has chimed in on her frustrations with breeders and the stupidity that they advise her doodle customers that certain things with the hair coat that they're supposed to do that are just atrocious and completely wrong. So it's not just me that runs into the breeder problem. It's other professionals that work in the industry, and I wish that there was some kind of regulation that could make these people be more accountable, make them actually have some level of education and knowledge, maybe mandate that they have to work with a veterinarian in order to sell these animals. Not in the manner that they are now, because clearly it's not enforced and nobody cares, but like, let's enforce it. Let's have the ability for veterinarians like me to find out who these breeders are and report them when we get these new puppies and kittens that come in, and they actually face a legal consequence, at least a fine, for not following the law, rather than create a law and turn a blind eye that they're supposed to have a state-issued health certificate and they're not. Do you know where that's more enforced? Interestingly, it's more enforced with horses and farm animals, because farm animals are largely used for consumption, and so people are gonna really care what they're consuming. And so the USDA is very, very serious about making sure those animals have their state-issued health certificate prior to sale. And on the horse side, horses, many of them go for some serious big dollars. You got some horses, that are $150,000. You're spending that kind of money, darn straight, you're gonna want an inspection by a veterinarian to prove that that animal's healthy. Why that same diligence doesn't apply to somebody spending $7,500 for a French bulldog is beyond me, but I digress. That's my episode for the day. Keep these emails coming. Susan, thank you for your email. Again, I'm happy to have more follow-up on that if you have any comments about my response to your email. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Sorry, I had a little bit of an ornery tone to my podcast, but as I told you before, this is very enjoyable to me because client education is one of my favorite aspects of my job, even when it's a little on the frustrating side. I just love spreading true medical facts and having people armed with the best knowledge they can possibly have to raise their companion animals in the healthiest possible way. This also, though, does wonders for me, especially, oh my God, when Dr. Karen was my co-host, it was like therapeutic and cathartic for us to kind of air our personal veterinarian grievances that we all share in common. So if you think your vet doesn't think like me or her, guess again. They're just as frustrated as we are when, "But my breeder said," see you later, everyone. Until next time.